Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Pro-Life Guys podcast, a show dedicated to equipping you with the tools that you need to have compassionate and compelling conversations about abortion so that together we can change minds, save lives, and transform our culture. My name is Cam. I am the host of the show, and welcome back to an episode of Humans of the Pro-Life Movement, a program dedicated towards highlighting the incredible women and men who are involved in varying capacities, in varying stages in the global pro-life movement. And today I'm joined by a very special guest. Janelle reached out to me via our email at prolifeguys.com and asking if she could share her journey of having three abortions and coming to the pro-life worldview. It is a profound and heart-wrenching and heartbreaking, but ultimately, as by God's grace, so often is the case, a story that is heartwarming in the end. And so I'm not going to put many more words towards before that. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Janelle. All right, Janelle, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the Pro-Life Guys podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. It's an
Yeah,
honor.
it is mutual. It's such a joy to be able to feature different people from the pro-life movement, from different walks of life and different experiences. And you actually went so far as to reach out to me and share a little bit of your journey, which was absolutely inspiring and very, very important for our audience to bear. We'll get into that in a moment, but maybe just kind of bring me up to speed on, I know that we're in the same time zone. Whereabouts are you living now? Has it always been home? What brought you there? Bring us up to speed. Whereabouts are you at now?
So I live in Colorado Springs, Colorado, the Sunshine State, other than California. We're a military family. My husband was in the Army for 25 years. We moved around a lot, and then we retired here. So we've been here for almost 11 years, where we saw our son graduate high school and go on to college. And we love it here. Hunting is great.
Cool.
So my husband's a hunt, avid hunter, so we just really love it here.
Fantastic. I live in Calgary, Alberta, which is just a bit north of you guys, also somewhat nestled in the Rockies. I'm sure the Rockies are a little bit different. And I promise I won't ask you too many questions about the Colorado Rockies or anything like that. Anyone who tunes into the show knows I'm a bit of a sports guy, but I will not impact our conversation too much with that. And so rather than that, I'll kind of give you the floor to share a little bit about your journey, and kind of the winding path that each and every one of us are on. We're all on different paths with different ups and downs and hurdles and whatnot. And I think that's one of the beautiful things within the pro-life movement, that there's certainly a plenitude of journeys, and that there is a mutual understanding that now we're working in the same direction, and that we're trying to do what we can to alleviate pain, suffering, trauma in our world, and try to bring about better support, better understanding, better a lot of better things. And so, rather than me rambling on and on, I'd love to kind of just give you the floor and share a little bit about your journey.
So my true journey really started when Roe v. Wade was overturned. That's really where God spoke to my heart, and I broke down. And to go back a little bit, when I was saved and baptized, I actually didn't want to be forgiven. I've had three abortions, and so I felt like I didn't deserve to be forgiven. And I carried that a lot of the time in my life, deep down. And when Roe v. Wade was overturned, I was excited and elated, but I felt guilt. I felt like, who am I to be excited over something when I'm the one that chose to have three abortions? And so it was a battle. And I reached out to my sister-in-law, who used to be a worship pastor, and said, what do I do with this? Because I don't know where my feelings are. I don't know what to do. She told me to reach out to a pregnancy center. And I did. And that was Life Network here in Colorado Springs. And I met with their abortion counselor. And that's where my journey began to unfold with forgiving myself, which was very hard to do. I ended up going into a retreat for 3 days. where God really, he put it on my heart. If I can forgive you, you can forgive yourself. And that moment I said, I don't care if I have to clean toilets or wash windows at Life Network to be a part of this. I need to be a part of this. I don't know how, I don't know why. So I worked for Life Network for over a year. I was in charge of doing an auction for our gala yearly, and I raised over $35,000 for two nights, and it just was a rewarding feeling. I felt like I was finally giving back and honoring God, and more importantly, honoring my children. God has lit a fire under me. After I left Life Network, God really pressed it upon me to tell my story. Live Action News actually published a column that I wrote about my story. And so they ran it for the month of December. And that was extremely healing. And so being on here is just another part of that healing process. So to kind of go back when I was just a little child to understand why I chose three abortions, because I think a lot of people don't understand that, because how can you have one, let alone three? My goal has always been, we've got to bring both sides into the middle to understand what a woman's story is and where she comes from before she walks through those doors and when she actually walks out of those doors. And so my story, from the earliest memory I have, I was around three or four. My mom was married to a younger man. My parents divorced at a very early age, and there was lots of dysfunction. My mom married him for the wrong reasons. He was very possessive over her, and so my brother and I were tormented by him, and I was therefore sexually abused by him. I don't have very many memories. My brain's blocked it out. I have bits and pieces. We were then sent to live with my grandparents in California, where my aunt and her fiance were living in the same home. And he instantly started grooming me and quickly began molesting me on a nightly basis. So he took my childhood. He stole my childhood innocence. He also at the same time stole my brother from me. My brother was very attached to him. God showed up in my life, and I went to school one day, and there was someone there talking about stranger danger and inappropriate touching. And I remember hearing a voice say, "You need to go home and test him." And I went home and I tested him, and I don't remember what happened, but he walked into the room with nothing on. From there on, I kind of came forward. I was sent to talk to detectives. They said, this is happening, but no charges were ever brought. A couple years later, my grandfather passed away and I needed to go live with my mom again. And so I went and lived with her. And her favorite brother, which was my favorite uncle, showed up one day. He was an Elvis impersonator, and so he was bigger than life. And he, again, molested me. I left. Something told me, get up and leave now. So I did. Held that for years, didn't tell anybody. As a survivor of sexual assault as a child, you carry this stigma with you. You carry this, the only thing I am good for is my body. Men don't want, you know, women who don't give out. I'm sorry to say it that way, but that is what was given to me, was that women are put on this earth to serve as men. And so I brought that into being a teenager and then becoming a young adult. When I was 13, I lost my virginity, and I remember wanting to be pregnant at 13. And as a an adult now, I understand why, because I was damaged. I was neglected by parents and not physically abused, but mentally was abused, and I didn't have a father in my life. He was there part-time. And so I was searching for something, and that something was, I need to have a baby. And I remember my friends thinking I was crazy. And luckily I did not get pregnant at 13. But when I was 16, I fell in love, or I thought was love, with an older boy, and I got pregnant. I didn't know I was pregnant. I was on the school campus eating lunch, and my girlfriend, I had eaten her lunch, and she said, I think you're pregnant. And I said, no, not possible. So I had to go tell my mother. And the thing I want to emphasize on is my mother was a young mother. She had my brother when she was 16. She came from a fire and brimstone Baptist kind of background. She, throughout my life, would say, please don't make the same mistakes that I've ever made. And I kind of carried that. I was deathly afraid of telling her. I thought, she's going to kill me. And at the same time, I had hoped that I could keep it. And because I still was that lonely little girl, and I was still that little girl who wanted something to love and wanted something to love me back. And I went home, and rightly so, my mother was furious. But more so when looking back, she was scared. She was filled with fear and told me, you're getting an abortion. You're not keeping this baby. If you do, you're going to end up barefoot and pregnant in the line of the welfare line, and you're not staying here. These are your choices. So at 16, I had a very difficult decision to make. And, you know, for years I would tell people, well, my mother made me have one. But the truth is I'm the one that decided. I'm the one that went through with it. I'm the one that walked through those doors. And so I have to own that. So I prepped for having this abortion. I don't know how you can. We had to drive 4 hours because we lived in Idaho and it was a pro-life, no abortions allowed. So we drove 4 hours to Washington State. And I was in the back seat of my mother's van and just curled into a ball under a blanket because I thought that was going to protect me. And I held my womb and I just kept saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't know God at that time. But I just kept apologizing over and over and over. I never thought for once that it was a clump of cells. I don't know why, but I just knew. I knew it was wrong, but I knew that this was just my only way out. I don't remember walking through those doors. I remember going into a waiting room, and it was like being cattle called. It was about 20 of us in this room with wood paneling, frosted windows. It almost reminded me of a morgue, to be honest. I remember sitting there and hearing these women talk about this is their third, this is their fourth abortion. And I just remember, what are you going to do after this appointment? And, oh, we're going to go to the bars and we're going to go party after this. And I just remember thinking to myself, I can't do this 3 or 4 times, let alone this time. The thing people need to understand is as a minor, they do not let your parents come back with you. They do not let your parents hold your hand to support you or to love you or to tell you you're okay. They tell your parents, go wait in the car and then pull into an alley. I remember being called back, and again, wood doors into this medical room with light green, pale green walls. I don't remember them telling me what was going to happen. I'm sure they discussed it. The abortionist would not even look me in the eye, would not talk to me, would not comfort me. The nurse would not touch me, would not comfort me. And so the noises began. I can't describe what you hear, but when they tell you that this is no big deal, it's just cleaning out your womb, it's a lie. You hear sounds that no human being should hear. It was a very quick procedure. In their mind, it was easy. They escorted me to the exit, where then I was put into my mother's van. Again, I cried all the way home. I was devastated. I said, I can't do this again. I need to be better. And again, apologized. Where you get home and you're then forced to go back to school. And you're forced to pretend that nothing happened. And you were just sick. And you put it deep, deep, deep down inside of you. And you want people to think that you're fine. And in reality, it's not. I believe your soul gets stripped a little bit each time. So I never graduated high school. Just because of my upbringing and the things that I had gone through, I was constantly in fight or flight. And so high school was just not a priority in my life. Then Job Corps commercial came on. I don't know if you've ever heard of Job Corps, but it's a place where you can go and get a skill, like a trade type of thing. What they don't tell your parents is that you're going to be in a dorm with boys and girls. And you're not supervised. They tell you you are, but you're not. I was around 17 and a half when I went, met a boy. We were in love, which I thought that's what we were. Became abusive. Would sneak into my room while I was at class and leave me things, which became very creepy. Began stalking me when I ended the relationship. Found out I was pregnant. And the only thing I could think of, I can't tell my mother. She's going to kill me, and she has every right to. I can't tell anybody. Went to our counselor, and she said, oh, Job Corps will pay for it, and we'll take you. I remember the car ride being very quiet, and I remember beating myself up, but I also remember disassociating, if you will. I remember just saying, this is something I have to do. I don't remember a whole lot of that appointment. I do remember the doctor coming in his wheeling stool, not looking at me, and getting started. And I said, can I hold the nurse's hand? And she looked at me with this panic look in her eyes and looked at him. And he said, that's fine. That's fine. Apparently they're not allowed to touch you or give you any comfort. Again, the noises that you hear, again, it's not a clump of cells. I don't care how far along you are. You can never get that sound out of your head, but you also can't explain it to people. Drove back, and I went to my dorm, and I cried myself to sleep. And again, put it deep down inside. And just, I was fight or flight. I had to survive. I got out of Job Corps, and moved in with a high school friend, and her boyfriend was in prison. I had known him since we were 16. Had a friend that wanted me to write to him. And being that I'm so damaged and desperate for a father, I didn't know it at that time that that's what that was, but I was desperate for love. Began writing this inmate. I was 19 and he was 34. He made it sound like he was in prison for just, you know, stealing a pack of gum, that he had learned his lesson, and he was this great prisoner and this great inmate, and I believed it. Fast forward a year, with writing to one another, he got on a work crew. So he got to leave prison and go clean our local cemetery, which was two blocks away from my apartment. And what I thought he was joking was that he was going to come and see me. And I thought, there's no way that they're going to just let him come see me. He paid the guard $5 to drop him off at my apartment. I was cleaning, and I thought, I saw him get out, and I thought, well, that he looks very familiar. And then I recognized who he was. At the time, I was 19, and I thought, if we get caught, I'm going to go to prison for aiding and abetting a prisoner. What do I do? He's on my doorstep. He said the guard's giving him 15 minutes to be with me. I wound up getting pregnant. I didn't find out I was pregnant until I packed up my belongings and moved to his mother's house. He was due to get out of prison in about 6 months. I had nowhere really else to go. I could have lived with my mother, but didn't want to. So I moved in with strangers. And about 7 weeks later, I found out I was pregnant. And I hid my pregnancy from my family. I hid it because I was very fearful that they would convince me I needed to have an abortion. And so for 4 months, I was on my own. I found out some very troubling things about this man. He was far from a great inmate or even, unfortunately, a great human being. And I knew I needed to protect my unborn child. I knew I needed to leave. I knew I needed to reach out to my mother, and I needed to get out. I wanted to do everything I could to make my child have a different life than I ever did. And being in that relationship, that wouldn't have happened. His stepfather took me to the bus station, gave me a hug, and he said, "I know what you're doing. You're very smart to leave, and please don't come back, because he will never change." My mother and stepfather opened their arms and opened their home and were great, loving parents, supported me through it all, found out I was having a little boy. And he's 25, going to be 26, and he's the greatest kid a mom could ask for. He's tried us a few times, but he's been a wonderful young man. And I protected him every turn I had, every chance I had. And I gave him a loving and caring home life. And my parents, my mother and stepfather, had a huge part in that. I think my mother was trying to make up for her lack of being a mother. And it was wonderful. My son had a male role model in my father. And I just, that's what I lived for, was to raise my child. Shortly after my son was born, he was around 6 months, I got a job. I bought a $500 beat up car. And I was asked out on a date, and it became serious very quickly. We moved in together, we got engaged, and I had to go to a pregnancy center and get paternity done for my son to prove that this is who the father is. And I found out I was pregnant. And during that time, the father and I were not in a great spot. I went home and I had God and I had Satan in my ear. I had, you can do this. And then I had, no, you can't. You're a single mother. You don't have a job right now. You need to leave this relationship. How are you going to raise two children? You made a promise to your son. You're going to fail in that promise. So I went back and forth, and with that time progressed. And back then, late term abortion was considered around 12 to 14 weeks. And I was around 12 weeks. It was going to cost me $2,000. That's, you know, the other thing that I'd like to get into is the money aspect of Planned Parenthood. But again, drove out of state. I do not remember walking in. I do not remember the procedure of how they dilated my cervix. I didn't really know what that was. They put us in a hotel across the street from them. And the best I can describe it is it was where prostitutes and drug addicts hung out. It was very dark. It was very ominous, is the best way I can put it. We closed the curtains. We locked every door. My mother was with me. And that's where I began the procedure of dilating and preparing for birth, which is, again, in that moment, that's not, I couldn't even think like that. I would be up all night thinking that I was going to give birth on the toilet. Again, I do not remember going to the procedure. I don't remember leaving. I don't remember any of that. The only thing I can say, it was very traumatic. And it was at that time that I just said, enough is enough. I can't do this anymore. And I just said, I have to live for my son, and that's what's important. I kept to that promise. After that third one, you're just broken and you have no one to talk to, because you either get, why are you upset that you had an abortion? It's not a big deal. It's women's health. Then you've got, well, you're a murderer. So I had nowhere to go. And again, you bury it. And I have a child to raise, and I needed to get a good job. And so I put myself through school. I became a dental assistant, making very good money, and I just lived for him. And then God sent someone, my husband. He was a military guy, and it was, you know, it was 2003, almost 2004. He just kind of planted him at a table in a restaurant, and very funny. And I had a lot of respect for him because of the war that we were in. We just became fast friends. More importantly, when my son did meet him, my son fell in love with him. Instantly fell in love with him. And that's when we would get married a year later. And that's when the depression hit and came out of nowhere. And we didn't know why. I was happily married. We bought a house. Everything was great. We were told later that it was because he made me feel safe, that I was able to release all this trauma. So throughout the years, when we got stationed at our first duty station as a married couple, And our friends would say, why are you not having any more children? You need to have more children. And my husband has a hard time telling me no, but he stood strong and said, I've only ever wanted to have one child. And at that time, I started to know who God was. And I thought, I'm being punished. I had a chance to have four children, and I took three of those away. And so this is my punishment. But my husband was very supportive and very loving and just said, we have one, we need to raise this one the right way. And I kind of let it go, but secretly caused me a lot of pain because I wanted to share something with him, a part of him, and that just wasn't going to happen. Through the years, I have talked with therapists about my abortions, but never gone into detail. So when Roe v. Wade was overturned, I was with a therapist, and even then she said, you will never go into detail. And I just said, I can't go through that. And just recently, I was able to do that. It's embarrassing. It's shameful. It's heartbreaking, painful. But I've given them a voice, and I wear them around my neck, and they have names, Olivia, Joel, and Madison. And, you know, telling this story is an opportunity to bring them to life because that's what they were. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard President Trump and all the great stuff that's happening here. And to hear people talk about abortion, it's hard. Because I want to scream and shout the truth, and people who are pro-choice don't want to hear the truth of what Planned Parenthood really is. And then you've got pro-life who, how could you do that? You know, that's a life. That's something that I will carry for eternity. And I can't take it back. And, but I can honor them. And so one of the things that just happened recently was a woman getting pardoned for praying at an abortion clinic. And that was 100% God. And it was amazing to hear that because I think more of that needs to happen. But I think people need to know the dirtiness that goes on when you walk through those doors, and the cold feeling that you get, and they scream and shout, it's women's health. It's women's health care. It's, we love the women and we want to embrace them. And it's actually nothing like that at all. Even if you are a woman who prides themselves on having five abortions, deep down in your soul, you're hurting. I know that. There's no aftercare. There's no therapy. There's no nothing. When I had my first abortion, it cost me $250. When I had my third, it was $2,000. And I learned very quickly that the farther along you are, the more money they make. And the doctors, and I've listened to a few ex-abortionists, and they say the same thing: is we don't have emotion when we go in. We go in, we do the job, we get paid, we leave. That's it, and that's really what it is. And so I think that both sides of the aisle have to understand, and they have to understand that a woman has a story, a woman has a reason for making that decision, whatever it may be. Whether it's selfish or fear, but I would like to love that woman that walks out in more pain than she was when she walked in.
I feel like I'm at a loss for words. I thank you for your courage and for the eloquence in sharing that journey. I mean, there's a million things bouncing around my brain, but I mean, gratitude is the greatest one, because I think there's so much that God can use your testimony and your journey in such beautiful and profound ways. I think about so many of my close friends and colleagues, and I think especially of two of our most active volunteers who have gone through a similar journey of abortion in their past, and how they are now advocating on street corners and on doorsteps, sharing their experience and helping people appreciate the truth of what abortion is and what it does to children, but also to mothers and fathers and families and everyone. And I mean, this has been a major push of mine in the organization now, that so often our first presentation that we're giving in churches is no longer purely apologetics and how to change hearts and minds kind of thing, but rather talk that we've been calling understanding abortion, where it's highlighting many of these elements. Often I don't highlight it anywhere near as eloquently and as well as you have, but to be able to showcase that this isn't a flippant decision. There's components of generational trauma, there's components of childhood abuse, there's components of all sorts of things. The number of people that I've talked to in high school and university who have literally never met a pro-life individual until they met me, and they say, well, is it weird that I've had multiple abortions? Like, what was the alternative? But like, it never entered my mind of not having an abortion. Sure, if there was another option, I wouldn't have had one, but another option was never presented. And so I thank you so much for sharing this, because not only can I fully appreciate having known so many who have worked and volunteered with Silent No More and about the healing component of sharing the testimony and sharing the experience, but also the profoundly life-saving component of,
yes,
yeah, how many people are going to hear this testimony, whether here on the podcast or whether the articles and other sharing places that you've had encounter this and say, hey, you know what, I don't want to go through that. I want to be where she is now, not where she was then, kind of thing.
Yes.
I thank you for that.
You know, the biggest thing is when I went to Life Network and worked there, I got to see behind the scenes and what they really do for our women and even our men and the children that they have. And that was the first thing that I ever said is, where was this when I was pregnant? Where was that education to make a decision? Because again, I was never given adoption or open adoption or having the baby. And hey, there's these programs out here who will walk you through that. And the biggest argument that, you know, pro-choice has is, well, you're not there for the women and the children when the babies are born. Well, I can attest that Life Network, who just opened their fourth pregnancy center here in the Springs, they support the women and the babies and the men for 2.5 years after the baby is born. And that's diapers, car seats, counseling, motherhood groups, fatherhood groups. They learn how to be a real father to their child, especially because majority of these people coming through those doors are missing that. And that's I think the biggest thing that we all have to look at again is what kind of fathers did they have and family home. And, you know, you hear a lot that, you know, I come from a very strict Catholic home, and you have that fear of I'm going to be disowned. And so I never had that opportunity. And I wanted to also include that, and I said this in my email to you, is I got to be a chaperone during an ultrasound, and God just shined a light of truth. I've always known the truth. I was always knew that this was not a clump of cells, but I got to be there for a teenager and pray silently over her and the baby. And I remember looking at this little tiny baby, and she had left the room, and I asked the ultrasound tech, how far along is she? She says, she's 8 weeks, 4 days. And I looked at that baby because it was a baby. It had a head, he had arms and legs, he had a little butt, he had a spine, and you could clearly see his heartbeat. And thank goodness God said, do not cry. But I went to my desk and I sobbed. For an hour, I just sobbed. Because that is 100% truth. And you can call it a parasite. You can name it whatever you want in order to feel good at night. But the truth is it had a heartbeat. It had arms and legs. It had a brain. And he was moving around. And you can't convince me otherwise.
And that's an element on so many different factors. I am so grateful for the time that we live in now with the access to information around ultrasounds and 3D ultrasounds and all this kind of thing to generate far more clarity and knowledge around developing life before birth and that kind of thing. But also the witness of people like yourself and so many others who I feel like in recent years have been coming forward to share this message, to make the pro-life worldview and the pro-life message so much more human. I feel like for so long it's been so academic and so caustic and so, I would argue, true, obviously, and yet so impersonal. And because of that, often at times, just inaccessible almost when it's a matter of, okay, well, yes, I want to agree with you that this is wrong. I want to agree with you that every life is valuable and all this kind of thing, but I can't. Look at my situation, look at my surroundings, look at my environment, look at everything, and that this is why there needs to be a comprehensive pro-life movement, that while abortions don't end by having support available for every mother and every father, that there is an educational component to it, that there is at times a political component to it as well, that it needs to be a holistic component that engages the entire person and not just a professor at the front with a stuffy lab coat proclaiming the truth of when human life begins, but also not just a bunch of lovely people in a pregnancy care center with ample supplies and diapers and all this kind of thing. We need a holistic approach. And so I know that I'm babbling now, I think that's beautiful. And so I guess to put that into a question of, since the Dobbs decision, since your involvement with Life Network and whatnot, and with your particular perspective and experience, and I mean, you've mentioned a few times on the podcast about what I think is a very fair, though unfortunate, stereotype of pro-lifers, of having a very hard line, not simply a hard line against abortion, not simply saying abortion is never appropriate, but having both a hard line and a hard response and a hard face and hard hands, that feels like at times. From your vantage point, how can we reshape the stereotype? How can we build a new stereotype that doesn't necessarily compromise on the truth that abortion is an inappropriate solution to even challenging pregnancies, but changing the stereotype of the face and the hands and the accessibility of the pro-life movement?
So I think the largest thing, you know, with Life Network, when a woman would walk through those doors and was undecided, and a lot of these women walked in thinking that we were an abortion clinic, and we would give them their ultrasound and their due dates and everything like that. And again, they each have a story. The thing I loved about the nurses there, and we would have motherhood coaches there. And, you know, the thing that I loved is they didn't shove down these women's throats scripture from the Bible. Majority of these women don't know who God is, or they've walked away from their faith, or they don't know what faith is or having a relationship with God. And so that's the last thing that they are even thinking of. But these women still show God's love. And I think that at the end of the day is God's love and speaking truth. And I think if more women can come and talk about their experiences and not be in fear of being shamed for it, or that you're going to go to hell for it, it's going to give those women who are thinking about abortion a knowledge, a truth, because a pro-lifer who's never walked into a clinic or has never gone through it can't really come to the same conclusion or come and sit down and say, I'm with you, I understand. And it's the same for a pro-choice, where you could be pro-choice again, but you've never walked through those doors. You've never experienced what that's like. And so a woman, I think, at the end of the day, needs to feel understood and heard. And when she has these doubts, that, again, scripture is wonderful, but to just love her and tell her, hey, I know you have these fears. I've been there. I've walked it. But there are all these programs out here to walk you through that. There is support. And I think that that is the biggest misconception, because pro-choice says, well, if you keep it, there's nothing for you. So that's where my goal has always been, is to bring both sides towards the middle of to understanding a woman's heart, and also to understand a man's heart, because men don't have a chance to say, I don't want you to have an abortion, because they've been raised, my body, my choice. And so they don't feel that they have that voice to say no. I remember reaching out to my last partner with the late term abortion and saying, I hope you can forgive me for taking that away from you. And his response was, well, it was the best choice for us, and it was your body. And I just thought, that really hurts my heart, because a man has a right to fight for that child if they want to. And so, yeah, I think the ultimate goal to get people to come to, this isn't what I want to do, this isn't the decision that I want to make, is you can't say, well, if you do this, you're a murderer. If you do this, you're going to regret it. It's, look, I've been through there. I've done it. And it will tear at your soul through your whole entire life, piece by piece, moment by moment. When you hold your firstborn child, and or you hear their heartbeat, or you see them on that monitor, it's going to hit you of what you've done. And again, women can tell me all day long that it's not effective. They were proud of doing it. Eventually, God is going to put them in a spot where they will. And so I think at the end of the day, we need to love them and have a heart for them and an understanding. And if they do choose to walk out and have made that decision, that you just wrap your arms around them and tell them, I'm so sorry. And, you know, it's the thing as well, and I'm hoping I'm not blabbing, but the fear factor, the amount of fear that a woman goes through when they're pregnant is astounding. Even when I chose to keep my son, it was a what if, what if, what if. And when you have a child, you want to keep them alive and you want to make them happy and you want them to be successful. And so you just, you know, it just needs to be humanized. At the end of the day, we need to treat these women like human beings and understand that they have that story. And it may be like mine, it may be different, but at the end of the day, you have a story to tell. And there's a reason why you chose to walk through those doors. And God was there the entire time. God was with you in that moment. I believe that God has welcomed my children. And again, the thing that God always tells me is just love them. A woman wants to know that she's not going to be called names for her decision.
And that, again, such beautiful words, and I could not agree more. I know that literally on the second page of our training booklet that we have, we often talk about a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who says, yes, whom you would change, you must first love, and they must know that you love them. That we need a culture of encounter, where we're listening to understand, not listening to respond, where we are meeting people where they're at, that we're bridging gaps with them and building support networks and building understanding, building community. Ultimately, as well, you touched on a number of occasions, the element of isolation and how vulnerable so many people are, not just mothers who are pregnant in challenging circumstances, but each and every one of us when we're isolated, when we are held apart and we have those voices in our head going on about your child deserves better, your family deserves better, you deserve better, all this kind of thing. It's very difficult to navigate the noise in isolation. And so building community where we're embracing and inviting of people of all walks of life and all histories and all backgrounds, and allowing ourselves to rub shoulders with people that we may not have anticipated rubbing shoulders with. And you know what? This is a beautiful opportunity that we have, whether as Christians, whether as people of goodwill, whatever we want to characterize ourselves as, that our world just needs more encounter. Our world needs more humane engagement, and not to be trending the way that our grocery stores are with more self-checkouts and all that kind of thing. And I'm sure I can understand why we don't have people at the tills in the grocery store anymore. even though I try to still go to them whenever I can, but that we can't turn our pregnancy care centers into production lines.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for coming in. You ticked off all these boxes. You head over here and head over there.
Exactly.
We need a culture of encounter. And yeah. And I thank you for being a huge part of that and for sharing your story and allowing your experience to open that opportunity, that space for pause, for consideration, for engagement, because that's going to resonate with so many people. And so, yeah, I thank you for that. I ask just more out of curiosity as we start to wind down this episode. It's been a blessing to have you on the program. I hope that each of the members of the audience are as impacted as I am hearing this story. But what's coming down the tube for you? You mentioned that you've been connected with Life Network. Obviously, you've shared this story here. You've shared it with Live Action. Is there anything else coming down the tube that we can highlight, that we can really draw our audience towards?
Not yet. I hope and pray that I can speak more. I think that speaking the truth and hearing, as hard as it is to hear the truth, brings me more healing, and brings, again, the voice to the voiceless, and that's the unborn. And so, yeah, I think this is, having my story be on Live Action News and then with you, it's just a stepping stone. And I know God has plans for me. I just don't know what that looks like yet. I've been told, he has whispered, tell your story, tell your story, tell your story. And I really didn't know what that meant. I didn't really know what direction. And so I think that this is the direction that he's been screaming at me, telling me. And so I'm just listening and hearing what he wants for me. And it's been an honor to be on your podcast. I was so excited and I felt so blessed. And I just felt like it's honoring my babies. And that's the most important thing for me.
Well, I'm thankful that I've been able to play a small part in that. And I thank you for sharing this. Thank you for all that you've done and that you continue to do. And I pray that the Lord will continue to allow you and your story to shape this culture, that we can, through lots of different efforts, continue to change the stereotype of pro-lifers, to change the way that we and the abortion advocates and everyone in the mushy middle understands abortion in our world and understands mothers and fathers and understands the struggles that real people are faced with, so that we can provide better support, both material and immaterial.
Yes. Everyone. Yeah. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. And hopefully we can find more opportunities and hope to maybe even have you on the show again sometime in the future.
I would love that. Thank you.
All right. That was my conversation with Janelle. I appreciate her courage, her grace, her eloquence in sharing what must be a very difficult story to recount and retell, but she does it so well. And thankful that it can be a healing process for her. And also I know that her story, I hope that it hits you in the feels and really helps you and I alike better understand abortion in our world, the why abortion at times is chosen. And Lord willing, this story will be used to help mothers and fathers currently experiencing challenging pregnancies choose life for their children. So thank you to Janelle for joining me, and may God bless each and every one of you abundantly, wherever you're at, however many hours are left in your day.